What we typically talk about as far as vision, and I do mean our actual seeing mechanism and our eyes and our ways of perceiving, really is what we call sight. Do you see that chart 20 feet away in the optometrist or ophthalmologist's office? Clearly, can you do it with or without lenses, whatever, but can you get adequate vision is what they usually say. The field that I'm working with is a branch of optometry called behavioral optometry, and they are the ones who make this distinction between what is sight and what is vision. So we've got this sight does not equal vision is kind of the basis that I'm trying to set out today. I need to explain, I am not an optometrist nor an ophthalmologist. What I fell into this field myself 3 years ago when I had a vision problem, not a sight problem. I was doing pretty well with my contacts, I could see 20/20. And I had lived my life being told that this vision problem, which was called lazy eye, was something that I could not correct because I was 6 years old when they found it, and they should have found it when I was 5. No. I was too old. This was a problem. Unfortunately, that thinking to some degree persists today. Now they'd be inclined, if it was me at this time, in the same symptomology, I might likely hear, well, if we find it by the time you're 8 or 9, that is a little unfortunate because when I learned of behavioral optometry, I was 44. And the doctor nicely said, yes, you do have this problem, same lazy eye, same findings that all the other doctors have said, except that he said, we can work with this if you choose to. And you can do something called vision therapy. Which was news to me, okay? I will go in a little bit later into what my case was and how it influenced me. But that is why I became interested in the field, because I became convinced after going through a considerable amount of improvement in my own life functioning that people need to know that there are options. I don't think people need to live until they're 44 years old before finally somebody says, yes, you can do this. I don't like the idea of limiting the human potential. So what we have is basically the field of behavioral optometry. It is also called developmental or functional. And the developmental optometrists comprise approximately 2% of the optometrists in this country. Ophthalmology in general does not embrace developmental or behavioral just because of a philosophical approach in the learning. So what I'd like to do, without taking you through too much tedium, is to do a little review of the eye. Many of us have forgotten high school bio, and so understand you're not hearing this from a doctor, but from a layperson who hopefully did pretty good in high school bio and college bio and all the reviews that the doctors have been giving her in recent times. Okay. So we have a picture here of the eye that's a little bit too big, but we'll approach it from one side. I'm not going to take you through each and every term. But I think that it's kind of critical to know a few principal parts of the eye. We all know that the pupil of the eye is what enlarges and contracts as we adjust to the light that comes into the eye. And it's right in here and controlled by muscles that dilate, and the sphincter muscle pulls it in. The cornea is this transparent covering over the eye. Notice that it's part of what is also called the sclera. The sclera is the white of the eye. The cornea is the part that's going over your iris, the colored part. They are the same fibers, but they're arranged differently. The conjunctiva, who had conjunctivitis as a child? Pink eye, okay. Mucous membrane over the eye, really rich in blood vessels. It's going to react to allergens. It's going to react to maybe, if you especially prefer contact lenses like I do, it's going to react to cigarette smoke. And the red eyes are your body's response. Okay, now, getting into how the eye functions a little bit more, and I'm going to be as careful as I can to try it, and if anyone has better, you know, training in ophthalmology or optometry and I get anything even distorted, I'm welcome, you know, I'd appreciate correction. Behind the iris here, your colored portion of the eye, you have the lens. Okay, now the lens is here and it is shaped for the purposes of this picture as if it's a static shape, but it's not. The lens is constantly moving and adjusting, okay, for your focus. Part of the difficulty that people have as we get middle age is that it loses some of its elasticity, and as it loses that, there she is, she's a perfect example in the back of the arms aren't long enough, okay, and that's, they traditionally, and even I think in a lot of behavioral fields, they're saying, you know, we're losing some of that elasticity. Some people are willing to go through a lot of focusing exercises to try to maintain the elasticity. And there is an optometrist in Southern California in his 70s who does not wear glasses nor need them for near or far work because he's willing to, he believes in it, A, and he's willing to go the extra mile. Most of us, my own optometrist says, go in comfort. When you need another lens, we'll prescribe it for you. It's a philosophical, you want to put this much into it or don't you? We have that elasticity is controlled here by the ciliary muscles and the ciliary process, which contract. Okay, they tighten and loosen in response. They give you more and less power. Now, that kind of goes right into when you are nearsighted. Anybody know the word for nearsighted in the
myopia.
Myopia. Okay? Traditionally what they say then is myopia is you've got too much power. You have learned to bring those muscles down so you can see close up. And you've done it so well, perhaps as a child, you loved to read. And you didn't know that while you were engrossed in that story and you were just being carried on and on and on, it was equivalent to your eye muscle, and they're the lens, picking up a suitcase and just marching on and on and on, and you're so intrigued with whatever's going on that you didn't realize you got cramp. Okay? And pretty soon that muscle does not want to relax, and we literally tend, the studies are building now that say we tend to become myopic because we tend to do so much near point work without an intervening relaxation. Let go of that suitcase, shake out the hand a little bit and pick it up. What they would say as part of visual hygiene then in the area of behavioral optometry is when you read, about every two pages or so, just pick up and go right back down. And it's equivalent to doing that little flex with the hand. You're letting that eye muscle react. And they do maintain that if you can train, it's very difficult to train a child to do that, but if you can, that the probability of developing myopia is greatly reduced. We're talking on a preventive level. If they were to draw a traditional thing in the textbooks, you might have recalled, here comes the light into the eye and it meets here in front of the retina, and that's why we're myopic. And that's the theoretical explanation that they have at this point as far as what happens in the eye. The opposite, of course, is having the light come in through the pupil and meet back here, well, past the retina, and we're farsighted. Wonderfully out there, but bring it up here, and something else begins to happen. A definition for astigmatism would be, this is always hard for me, even though I have astigmatism in both eyes, trying to understand it, basically, you don't get maximum acuity or clarity of vision at any distance without a lens, okay? And it has to do with cylinders and with the shape of the eye. My eye, they say this one is much like a football. It's kind of long this way and a little bit more rounded out that way, which has made putting a contact lens on a little interesting. It tends to rock. And that's why in the past, when it was always hard contact lenses, where some people simply couldn't be fitted, but the advances in contacts were remarkable. Okay. Now, one of the critical parts, very critical parts about this whole thing is back here in the area of what we loosely call the retina. And I always thought, okay, the light falls on the retina and we get our image. What I did not understand is that if we look at the back of the eye, upside down, okay, the area of this entire back of the eye that is responsible for real clear, clean sight is called the fovea centralis. It's minute. How minute it is that it is this dot but less. That dot is called the macula, which includes the fovea centralis. So we're talking an extremely fine, pinpointed area within each eye. Okay. This goes directly into what happened in my case. While I had two eyes that both saw, that little area that would give me the best vision was not aligned between the two. To look at me as a child, people would assume that I had no eye crossing problems or whatever. But in as far as them being accurately aligned to that degree, that one little tiny dot within the retina of each eye was going to match up and give me both eyes looking at the same thing at the same time, it was an impossibility. They didn't for some reason. My right eye looked upward and outward. My left eye looked downward and outward. And there the twain was going to meet. This was a definite problem. Now obviously, if both eyes stay on full force, then I have double vision. I did not know until I was going through vision therapy. I knew theoretically that my brain had decided to suppress the images from one eye, both the lazy eye. That allowed me to function. I have one image. The road is here. I can walk down it. Okay. As I went through vision therapy, I was, I think, fortunate, even though it was frightening at the time, to have one episode of double vision where both eyes decided to come on full force and show me exactly what my world would have been like. I was driving, and all at once, here's one road, and here's the other, here's the yellow line, and here's this. What do you believe? And I didn't know until I did some, what I did was close an eye and hold it to the side of the road and work on a little bit. But, As I got interested in the field and wanted to learn more about it and visited with vision therapists, what I found out was that had I followed that image that I had to the right, I would have been wrong and gone off the road. Had I followed the other road, I would have been wrong and gone off the road the other way. Mm-hmm. Had I been able to make myself an imaginary image that was not visually there, but just simply said, right in the middle is what I want, I would have stayed on the road. But I would have had no visual guide. It would have been simply going on faith that somehow I was supposed to be in the middle of the two. I'm very, very grateful. It only happened one time. But on a deep experiential level, I now know why the brain said, no, this is too much. Let's get rid of the vision of one eye. So I've mentioned the suppression of one eye. We might be able to experiment a little bit if, let's see.
One way?
No. Well, what I think I'd like to do is find a visual target for you. Okay. Choose something. This stands up fairly well. OK. okay, as an object. And what I would like you to do is take your hand and put it just at a comfortable, what we call a harmony distance, about the distance from your elbow to your fist, about that far from you. And line it up so you've got, don't want to stand in front of anybody, so you've got your finger in the mirror and the black line in the back, okay? And you focus on your finger and you try to observe what's happening in the distance. What do you get? Pardon?
2 lines.
Do you get two? Mm-hmm. And how many get 2 lines?
Two fingers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Where are you focusing when you get 2 fingers? On the black line?
Yeah. On the black line.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you're focusing on the black line, you're inclined to get 2 fingers.
Yeah.
If you're focusing on the one finger, mm-hmm. you're inclined. That's called a physiological diplopia. And most of us, our bodies just automatically kind of take care of it for us. They, you know, it's okay to do a little suppression so we can get around. It's an example of how we don't think about that, but in order for you to move around, you probably, most of us, if we were to point at something, wouldn't think that we were seeing 2 fingers here and 1 object there. But if you allow yourself to do that, you will commonly get it, okay?
Interesting thing for me, because my central vision is gone in the one eye, that I do get the double, but when I close my bad eye, then I lose it.
Right, because it's coming out of the use of both eyes. And so, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. In order for my body not to have constant double vision, it was as if even though my eye was open, my brain just said no images from the weaker eye. And that allowed me to have one thing to deal with. Something else happens though. That also throws you into a two-dimensional world. Your world is much like looking at that picture back there. Okay? A better picture would maybe be if we had, this is quick artwork. This is my house. And this is the tree that lives in front of my house, right? Okay, well you can't see that part of the house there because the tree is in front of it. I can tell you from firsthand experience, that's how you grow to know your world. Oh, you can't see part of the house, that means the tree must be in front of the house. You don't, with that lack of binocularity, with only 2 dimensions, the idea of that tree popping out, as it were, like those little books that we had as children, and you could open them up and the little things would pop out, okay? That aspect of vision wasn't there for me. I lived in a world that was basically plain. I had not much ability to discern. I could tell definitely this gentleman is friend of that lady because I can't see part of her sweater. Now I can tell that he's in front of her by a goodly distance, but that ability to tell what the distance was or what that sense of relief in artist terms is, that wasn't there. I can tell you a little bit of my section on psychology about some of the overflow of living in a two-dimensional world and then trying to move into a three-dimensional world. That was interesting. Okay, now, so we've talked about how the eyes need to be able to point at the same object in space at the same time in order to give you that nice relief effect. Three-dimensional helps a lot with spatial orientation. Related to that, is what happens with our eyes, which need to look at a book, do what they call convergence. They come together at a fairly near angle, okay, for want of a better word. To look in the distance at a tree, they are still converging in space further out, But relative to this amount, looking at the book, this is called divergence. Okay? That's a skill that may and may not be in place for some people. It is a skill that is traditionally not tested for in most eye exams. It has a great deal to do with our learning ability. It also reflects upon our focusing ability, because if we have to look at a book, say this instead of a tree is a chalkboard, and I'm a child in school, and it's my task to copy what the teacher put on the chalkboard onto my paper. We had a case in my hometown just like this. The little girl would look at the chalkboard and she would see what the teacher wrote, clearly. When she looked down to copy it, her focusing ability was not quick. And so what I look out and see a tree and I look and see you, and there's not any problem, it's an instantaneous thing. For this little girl, it was 4 seconds. And then she'd write down what she, when she could see clearly, and she would look up, and it was another 4 seconds to get the next segment clear, and another 4 seconds back here. She was one of these, most kids are, they want to do it right, and they'll try. And she did, and she had dark circles under her eyes. You could see the stress in this poor child. They put her into, quote, vision therapy, and her mother was very good about making sure she did these exercises to stretch the ability of her eye to change its focus quickly and readily. And she went very, very quickly then into a situation where all at once she started, within about 2 months, really, to physically look better. She lost those dark circles, and even though she had been a good student because she applied herself, she was doing it with more ease. It was not a matter of can you do it and can you get by, but what's the ease, what's the ability to function. The other thing that sometimes, actually I would say often, is not addressed is the subject of our eye movements as we go from side to side. Across a line of text, as a musician, it's not just side to side, it's up and down. Pianists have got all sorts of things, and a conductor gets even more. Shortly after I discovered how vision was influencing my life, as a piano teacher, I started to look at my students and say, wait, are some of these students maybe having difficulty because they don't have some of the visual skills? And I did a little reading and was just getting into it, used an educator's checklist. So I learned to ask them, here would be, this is some text. This is not for anything but the idea of having some text here for illustrative purposes right now. You can tell I'm not used to overheads. Okay. So I began to ask the students something like, if you read along a text, you know, a line, and you get to the end and it's time to read the next line, does your eye go right to the next line, or do you discover that you're reading the same line over again? Or maybe you're down on the line right below where you plan to be, and then you've got to go, wait, that doesn't make sense, and back up. And I see some head nods, and that's not surprising. I expect about maybe 25% of the room to be going, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And we try to cope for it with it. Those eye movement skills are real critical, and they go back in relationship. Again, to this tiny little fovea centralis. You have to be able to coordinate smoothly the movement of both eyes. No little stutters or jerks, or it's going to land you in the wrong spot on the page. Okay? It can do other interesting things. Little stutters or jerks, my husband, I don't think, minds very much when I use him as an example. Cause things like he was in college at one point reading things like this. Under stress, those little stutters and jerks would become more pronounced, like anything, under fatigue or stress. And he would omit short words. And he had a classic case where he did an essay exam. And he wrote, boy, the answer to that thing as well as he possibly could, but he had it nailed. And the professor called him in and he said, I don't understand why you answered this question in this way. And so they looked it over. And as he read the question, he discovered that the word that his system had decided to drop was not. And he had answered the whole thing in verse. It can get in your way. It can get in your way. So I'd like to do a couple more things briefly. I'd like to do a little bit of a review of what we have as eye care professionals. They all have a very valid, strong place. What we need, I think, is a coordination between the fields. We have ophthalmology. They're wonderful with the surgeries, with the cataracts, with the ocular diseases, you know, and they're medically trained as well as having knowledge of lenses. We have the optometrist. The optometrist is not allowed to do surgical procedures. In the state of Washington, they can now prescribe drugs and treatment, and they are optometric physicians. That's something that's changing quite a bit nationwide. We have the optician, who is the dispenser of the lenses, who does the prescription the way they're supposed to be, gets them to you in a way that's going to work for you. When you talk about behavioral optometry, then you're talking about a doctor who is working basically postgraduate work beyond what he did in optometry school. There's 16 optometry schools in the country, and it might be 15, but approximately, and they all teach basically the same thing. The optometrist who wants to do behavioral work may get some orientation to it at Pacific University. They may still get some orientation to it at State University of New York. But basically, they all have to do postgraduate work. They are working in another area, and like I say, at this point, there's only about 2% who are doing it. The field has been around approximately 50 years. It's been growing and evolving over that time. It's had a lot of question. Which is understandable, and the standard medical model is, well, you tell me this, you observe on a clinical level, now where's your research? Well, the gap between what you observe in the office and doing the studies and putting it together and getting the proof on a clinical level is typically, in any field, 20 years. So, and they're struggling with that same type of thing as a newly emerging thing, although the research papers have really increased in the last 20, 30 years. I've drawn a number of references. I think at this point, I'd kind of like to throw it open for a little bit of discussion. And if there are questions, using today to set out basically what is probably a new definition of what the visual system is. And it, when I say sight does not equal vision, when I started reading it, it took me months to absorb it. So I'm not expecting people to go, oh, sure, crystal magic, this makes sense. So if you have any questions at this time, go ahead.
Well, I realize that I have two other problems. You are talking about, or maybe three, the lazy eye and skipping rows and short words. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, I stopped working as a nurse because I got so scared sometimes missing two letters from the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought it had something to do with my personality. And I'm glad to hear it's kind of those eyes and it can be corrected now. In Seattle, is there somebody who works with this?
Yeah, I could explain a little bit of what I decided to do as my response to learning about the field. As I went through vision therapy and told people what I was doing, everyone said, what is this? I've never heard of it. So I decided that I would like to screen people and be able to tell them if there is a possibility that they have that type of an overlay going on. But I knew that I couldn't screen people unless I had a referral system, because there are 30 doctors approximately in Western Washington who do with it. Yes, and there are about four, and I have lists and names and addresses, and also some appointments now. I spent last fall being very assertive about this whole thing and marching myself into all of these optometry offices and saying, are you really doing it? And how do you do it? And what's your approach? And this is what I would like, that you exist and that it's another option if it's necessary for people to know that it's there. So that was one of the things I did, was A, to be trained, and I brought my ophthalmic telebinocular screening machine with me, and I keep it in Chalet 10, and I'm willing to do screening procedures, which are preliminary, as well as referrals. I also have nationwide directory for two of the organizations for these doctors to confront that.
Is there therapy for macular degeneration?
I just heard. I know that it's a big subject and it's being addressed on both the ophthalmological and the optometric level. And I just heard on Paul Harvey the other day that the ophthalmological approach, which I don't know a great deal about, has come up and said antioxidant vitamins and minerals are being extremely effective in macular degeneration, which would be in keeping with what behavioral optometry would say. And the antioxidants, I don't know them all, are B vitamins, C, E, beta carotene, zinc, selenium. There's actually a formulation now, a number of different formulations of vitamins for vision, so to speak, and I've been carrying around little samples that some of the doctors had too many of, called Ocubites. And some of the doctors are saying, yeah, this is all right. These are just basically antioxidants. And it's a doctor's call as to whether or not to dispense those. But yeah, that's the latest that I just heard. And both fields would endorse that. Whether or not, if nothing is 100% for every situation, but hey, I explore all my options.
Now my brother has macular degeneration, but his is quite far gone. But he does take that Ocuvite. His doctor,
does he?
His ophthalmologist prescribed it.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. That's in North Carolina.
There's also, well, that belongs more in tomorrow's session on vision and learning, but there's also the whole subject of colored filters for reading. Sometimes done, you know, what they call scotopic sensitivity syndrome. And that's, in some cases, really proved to relax the system and allow a person to process information easier than the black and white. Sometimes it's just too much contrast for some readers. I have something that's very interesting to me on the subject of the eye movements. This is why behavioral optometry is very heavily involved in learning and learning disabilities. The ability to move the eye is very interesting. What you have on the left is Nefertiti, Egyptian queen. What you have on the right is a tracing, which they can now do with their instrumentations, of the eye movements of a given individual as he or she viewed this picture. And what they've discovered is, A, that everybody has their own particular way of viewing objects. okay? But in general, you see a heavy concentration around angles and points of higher, quote, visual interest. Angles seem to be real dominant, angles and contours. Again, around the ear, see the, and the outermost level, sometimes you see it, the eyes moving in response to that. Now, the most interesting experiment that I was told of was apparently done with prisoners, and prisoners, as it was told to me by anatomists, will do a considerable amount for money. And they had a vision exam that involved studying how the eye movements worked. And they had simple cards that would maybe have a wagon, a tree, commonly recognized objects, commonly recognized easy words. And each day they were able to electronically attach sensors to the musculature of these people's eyes and attempt to discern what they were doing. And each prisoner, as he looked through and said, this is a tree, he had to vision, you know, verbally identify, this is a tree, this is a wagon, this is the word such and such. So at the end of that first day, prisoner A looked at the wagon in his own particular way. Prisoner B looked at the wagon in his own particular way. And so they saw all that they had the distinct ways of viewing. So the second day, they did exactly the same thing. And what we had was prisoner A viewed the wagon in basically the same way that he did the day before. Prisoner B, you see, they all not only had their own distinctive way, but it was repeated from day to day. Well, after 3 days and being real certain that they were going to, in fact, say and do the same thing each time, they managed to use their instrumentation to take the viewing of the object out of the control of the individual and allow the machine to direct the eyes over each object. And to a person, they said, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. Now this makes a lot more sense for me of the article that just came out in the New Yorker, which was May 10th of this year, about a man who was 51 years old, they call him Virgil for sake of privacy, I believe. He was blind from about the age of 5 or 6 until he was 51. They discovered that they could basically restore his sight with relatively simple and not too high-risk surgery. And they did. And it was a neurologist, Oliver Sacks, who wrote a long, detailed follow-up on Virgil. And I think the expectation was that when Virgil received his sight, he was to get married. His fiance wanted him to be able to see her on their wedding day, and so that Virgil would see. What they didn't understand is pretty much what behavioral optometry is teaching. Virgil was going to have to learn to see. It is a learned function. What he got when he came out of surgery was theoretically something like what an infant has. Form, shape, color, movement, but not distinct objects. So the study affirms that. The person develops their systematic way of looking at things. And what Virgil's case would say on an anecdotal level, not only do we learn by looking at things in repeated ways and developing our style of looking at things, we learn by touch. We were at the bed and breakfast, Holden bed and breakfast, the night before we came up. We got up for breakfast and a little girl that we hadn't seen the first night, she was already being put down, was 2 and a half and at our breakfast table. And as soon as breakfast was over, she was over looking at my husband, and my husband has a beard. She over that beard with her fingers, and her mother said, oh no, you know, don't do that, honey. And I said, yes. She's putting together something new that she has seen with her eyes, and she needs touch. They took Virgil because he wanted to go to a zoo. And in theory, apparently, it was more enticing to Virgil than it was to be there. Because when he got there, he was not allowed to touch. And he apparently made some relations to, you know, and observations that kind of told people, yeah, he seems to be seeing that that's a giraffe. And he seems to be relating to a long neck. They finally found a statue of a gorilla. And they said, go to it. Touch. And he touched that statue, and then, like, quickly find what he said. Okay. In general, it seemed to us that Virgil could identify an animal either by its motion or by virtue of a single feature. Thus, he might identify a kangaroo because it leaped, a giraffe by its height, or a zebra by its stripes. But he could not form any overall impression of the animal. It was also necessary that the animal be sharply defined against a background. He could not identify the elephants, despite their trunks, because they were at a considerable distance and stood against a slate-colored background. Finally, we went to the great ape enclosure. Virgil was curious to see the gorilla. He could not see it at all when it was half hidden among some trees. When it finally came into the open, he thought that though it moved differently, it looked just like a large man. Fortunately, there was a life-size bronze statue of a gorilla in the enclosure, and we told Virgil, who had been longing to touch all the animals, that he could, if nothing else, at least examine the statue. Exploring it swiftly and minutely with his hands, he had an air of assurance that he had never shown when examining anything by sight. It came to me, perhaps it came to all of us at this moment, how skillful and sufficient he had been as a blind man. How natural and easily he had experienced his world with his hands, and how much we were now, so to speak, pushing him against the grain, demanding that he renounce all that came easily to him, that he sensed the world in a way incredibly different. His face seemed to light up with comprehension as he felt the statue. It's not like a man at all, he murmured. The statue examined, he opened his eyes, turned around to the real gorilla standing before him in the enclosure. And now, in a way that would have been impossible before, he described the ape's posture, the way the knuckles touched the ground, the little bandy legs, the great canines, and the huge ridge on the head, pointed to each feature as he did so. So it's very interesting. We're just beginning to learn how the visual system learns and how we develop it. But that's the basic tenet of what we're talking about. It is a developed skill, and if it doesn't develop easily for some reason, somewhere along the line, then we can have difficulties with learning disabilities. We can have an interesting overlay into juvenile delinquency. The student is expected to do this. Everybody knows how bright many criminals are. Very brilliant, devious minds. there was a 12-year program in San Bernardino involving a doctor named by the name of Stan Cassino. And how am I doing your time? Okay. Stan?
12:30.
Okay. Stan Cassino went to a juvenile correction agency, and through a series of fundings for 12 years, they established a way of him being able to test the juvenile delinquents for possible visual problems, working with them on a 21-month program, and then following what happened to them after. And there were three significant things. where their, quote, IQ measurements had averaged 90 on entrance, they averaged 95 after the program. IQ is learned. It is not a static that we're born with and live with. B, their grade reading level was an average of fifth grade. It went to 8.5. This is in 21 months. What's probably most significant is by the juvenile detention center's own account, 50 to 60% of the juvenile delinquents would be rearrested and come right back into the same facility. The students, or the juveniles who went through his program, came back at a rate of 10%. I maintain that we have a lot of people who are expected to function in our society and don't have the skills, and it's the frustration and their response of avoidance. When you're hit with something you can't do, you can either do what I did as a good little girl who went through college anyway, even though it was hard, you did. You can respond with compensation, find other ways, become an auditory learner, never quit a class, you know, never skip a lecture, or you can avoid it. It's very easy, just do it. And I think that what we have in the juvenile system is a lot of people who said it's just easier not to do this. I don't know why. Plus, they can. Your self-esteem goes way down. You can't do what Johnny and Susie do, and as children, they pick up very quickly on if they measure up, no matter what subtle things the educational system does to try to disguise the fact that this kid's doing better and that kid isn't figuring it out. So, you know, they can figure it out on the playground talking to each other. So that I'm not going to go any further with anything that I have at this point, unless there are, you know, specific questions that I can try to field. I'll tell you that I can.
So beauty really is in the eye of the beholder.
You want to elaborate on that?
The way you look at things.
Mm-hmm.
The pattern that you use, and some things are beautiful to you that are not beautiful.
That's an interesting point. And I think that you touched in another level on what I think is the most dangerous assumption that we run around this earth on, which is, I see what I see, obviously you see what I see. Maybe not. And I see this with a great deal of ease, so you must too. We did it to my poor stepfather, and we had no idea what we were doing. This child was obviously brilliant. I talked to her, and she came up with things that were incredible for her age. Could she do well in school from the age of third or fourth grade? We laid it to a custody battle, a lot of stress going on at that time, which probably didn't help. She barely made it through high school on D's. She tried, we had her in a private school, she made her own choice and chose to go with her mother, you know, everything, all sorts of options. I finally, when she was 20, was when I learned about this and said, I want you to have an eye exam from my doctor. We paid for it, she went. And I said, yes, as we're in the examining room, she said, oh, you know, she said, my eyes try to cross. I said, they do? How'd you find that out? She said, oh, the doctor I went to in Southern California said that my eyes try to cross. I said, what do you do about it? She said, I don't know, nothing. So then we went in, and my doctor indeed said, okay, this seems to be what's going on. And he said, you have options. How would you like to have new contacts? Would you like reading glasses? You can wear over your contacts when it's time to study. Oh, that sounds good. I can wear my present contacts and just have reading glasses. Well, the reading glasses he designed weren't so much a matter of magnifying or bringing things up like we think of reading glasses. They were designed to catch that jiggle in her eyes and help them stabilize. So she got her glasses, and I said, how is it? And she said, when I was in the doctor's office, he had that machine in front of my face. And he said, now when you wear your reading glasses, this is how it'll look. And he flipped all the buttons. I knew right then it'd be okay because everything stood still. This child had loved to read
read, and every time she tried to read, all the words danced around on the page. She had a headache almost every day of her life. And every year, we took her in to have her eyes checked. And every year, it was just have her wear these glasses and she'll see more clearly. And then we solved the real problem. So what we did, unfortunately, to that child, like I was saying, psychologically, was she was so frightened. We'd say, Tara, if you just try harder, we know you can do it. And we thought we were being supportive. We thought we were giving the best we could for her self-esteem, which was obviously not too good. What we were doing was saying, if you would try harder to a person who was probably trying 10 times as hard as the average person on the street, you know, and just frustrating the devil out of her. But we didn't know, and we're trying to be nice about it. Forgiving of ourselves for what we didn't know at that time. And it's interesting to watch, you know, the young lady emerge and the confidence that's coming out of this. That's my, the angle from which I will approach tomorrow's vision and learning, Wednesday's vision and psychology, and Friday is vision and music. Because I was a music teacher, and there's other things demanded of us visually as musicians that aren't demanded in text.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody else reading the title thought this had to do with psychological, religious
vision.
Yeah,
vision.
That's what I didn't realize it would be about sight and eyes. I'm glad.
Yeah. I'm glad you came too. And I wish I had found a better way. And it wasn't, I had written my titles before I came, and when I came, after about the time I turned in my title, it became apparent that a lot of people were saying vision in more of an abstract.